Hello everybody, welcome to Hold the Line. My name's Joe and I'm a British force-free gundog trainer. You can check out my online courses at forcefreegundog.com. The newest course is called Training the T-Drill. You can also pick up a copy of my book called Force-Free Gundog Training, The Fundamentals for Success, which is available on Amazon's everywhere around the world. There's also an accompanying workbook to record your training sessions in. I'm currently working on a sequel to Force-Free Gundog Training, and I hope it's going to be out maybe in about 6 months. We'll see. That's all for now. Let's get on with the show.
Train your gundog without force or fear. Motivate and educate. Hold the line is here. Prevention, repetition, generalization, motivation. Hold the line. Oh yeah.
Hello everyone. Welcome back to Hold the Line. I'm going to talk a little bit to start with about my new course Steady, which I've just uploaded to forcefreegundog.com, just to give you kind of a deeper dive into what the content is and what it's all about really and who it's for. So it's for spaniels. So if you have a spaniel, it's going to be for you. And it's for the owners of pointing breeds. So if you've got a dog which points, it's for you. Generally, think about it. If your dog hunts before the shot or is expected to hunt before the shot, then this course is going to be for you because it's about what happens when the dog finds the game and during the shot of the game and the fall of the game and all that kind of part of things. So it's important to note that there are different requirements for dogs in different places. So in North America, you probably want your dog to, if it's a pointing breed, come onto point and remain in a stand on a point while you go in front and kick up the game. And the dog just continues standing. The dog does not flush. The handler, as it were, walks in front and flushes. And then the game is shot and then it falls. And the dog just stands throughout all of that until they're sent to retrieve. In the UK, it's a bit different. So the dog will find the game and point. And then on cue, with your flush cue, will get in and put the game up for you to shoot. Then when the game flushes and goes up, the dog will sit, usually. So it's acceptable if a dog will stand, but it's usually trained as a sit. And then the dog is sent for the retrieve. So it's a little bit more complicated. And I think that often this complication goes a little bit overlooked. People don't appreciate the complexity of the sequence. And there is lots of things which go wrong as a result of that, I think. It's always worth unpacking the sequence in terms of learning theory and as seeing it as a chain, really, which is what this course does. So I think one of the most difficult bits or one of the most difficult requirements here is for these breeds, the HBRs in the UK, which are expected to kind of go hunt, stop, point, go flush, stop at flush, go retrieve. That is a lot of stop, go stuff going on there. And that is really difficult for a dog to have that level of control in the presence of a reinforcer and when that is happening as part of a chain. So that's what this course is aiming to take apart and deconstruct. And we're going to do that with flirt poles and tugs. So there's no requirement for access to game on the course. If you want to get an idea of what the course is about and who it's for, by the way, the first two videos of the course are free and you can preview them. So if you just go to the course page and scroll down to find the first two videos, you'll see a green button there which will say preview, and you can click that button and we'll open up the video. So you can watch the first two videos of the course to get a better idea of what the course is about and if it's going to be helpful for you. So we begin the training with tuggy toys, and at first, the very first bits may not look too different to some other play, tug play courses that you might have done with your dog before. So it's about how to play well with your dog. It's about getting a reliable drop cue on the tuggy. And it's about having a cue which tells the dog that they can get the tuggy again. So I use the word tag, but you can use any word that you like to tell the dog they can get the tuggy again. So that way we have control over the end of the tuggy game because we can say drop and we train a reliable drop, and we have control of the beginning of the tuggy game because the dog won't begin the game until we say tag. So that's the kind of nuts and bolts and setting things up to work. At that point, we then begin to use the tuggies. So we begin to use two tuggies. So when the dog drops one tuggy, we reinforce with tag to a second tuggy. This creates what I call the space in between. So the two toy game is a very well-known game in bite sports, for example, and with training dogs that using Tuggy. So we're kind of using that game, but the reason that we're using it is because of the space which develops between switching from one tug to another, because it's in that space that you're going to start to see some pointing behaviors happening, some self-control happening, and you're going to begin to get these kind of baby behaviors that we can grow. So I won't go into it in too much detail as to how we actually do that, because that would just be like hours of me talking about it and might not be very interesting, but that's what the course is about. We then move on to steadiness to a moving tuggy. So by this, we have a tuggy that's on the floor that we're moving away from the dog, and we want the dog to go into a default sit in order to be released to get the tug. Now, if you are in North America, instead of a default sit, you would want just a stand. And then as soon as the dog is holding back, hanging back in their stand to that moving tug, that's when you would release the dog. So that's why it doesn't really matter too much what behavior it is that you want, whether it's a stand or a sit, because it's all about knowing what behavior you want in the first place and then capturing that behavior by releasing the dog to the tug when they are doing that behavior, so that we kind of capture the behavior we want, whether that is a sit or whether that is a stand. So we reach the point where we can move a tuggy around on the floor, and as soon as the dog sees the tuggy moving, they go into their default position in order to be released to get the tug. And we make sure that that is really strongly trained. And I mean that I will be verbally really exciting, going, whoa, what's this, moving it around on the floor. And I want the dog to be able to go into their sit, despite my high excitement levels about the tuggy. So once we've reached that point, we then get out the old flirt poles. So many of you will know what flirt poles are. Many of you may not know what flirt poles are. So I've been using flirt poles before I even knew that they were called flirt poles. I was using a horse lunging whip originally, which is just a really, really long kind of horse whip. It's got a kind of rigid handle and then a flexible whippy cord bit, which comes out the end of the handle. And then on the end of that cord, you can tie a tug toy. I found that the full length horse lunging whip was too long and just too unwieldy, and I couldn't get it all off the floor. It's just too long, basically, for our purposes. So I used some cable ties and I strapped the dangly bit of the whip tight to the handle to reduce the length of it. It sort of doubled it up on itself and strapped it to itself and tied a tuggy on the end. But you can buy purpose-made flirt poles, which are specifically for dog sports. So you can also look at those. I think horse lunging whips are cheaper, which is why I kind of go with those. And there was a while when people were talking about flirt poles, and I had no idea what a flirt pole was. It sounds kind of sexy, doesn't it? What the heck is a flirt pole? It makes you think of pole dancing. Anyway, then I discovered that actually it was basically a horse lunging whip. So yeah, you might want to get a flirt pole or a horse lunging whip, it doesn't matter which, for the next bit of the course, because then what we do is we go outside. We don't need lots of space. We just need a space big enough to be able to wield our flirt pole. And we generalize the behaviors that we've been getting on the tug onto our flirt pole. The flirt pole is way more exciting than a tuggy for a lot of dogs, because it makes the tuggy seem more alive to a dog, because it's more separate from you. So it's on the end of this whippy thing, and it looks like it's a separate thing to you. So it's almost like it is a little animal. So I think it kind of results in a lot more sort of high arousal for the dog and excitement levels for the dog. And for our purposes, that's actually really good, because it's still not going to be as exciting as game. Probably nothing's going to be as exciting as game. But if we can get this trained to these higher arousal levels, then we've got a better chance of this working when we move it on to game. So yeah, we kind of use the flirt pole and we transfer the skills to the flirt pole. This means both the sort of pointing of it and not trying to get it. And on the course, I frequently repeat the idea that the message we're trying to get across to the dog is, the more you want this thing, the more you want to get released to have this thing, the more you have to not try to get this thing. Once we've got that concept across to the dog, it's then just about selecting the behaviors that we want, whether it's a stand or whether it's a sit, so that we can release the dog to the flirt pole when the dog shows those behaviors. So there's a little bit more involved than that, but I think that is the kind of basis of it. And then we also sort of do some proofing for purposes of, you know, handler being able to walk around. So if you're a North American, you want to be able to walk in front of your dog while they're on point, we can kind of do that a bit with the flirt pole too. We can walk in front of the dog, we can kick up the grass around the dog, and we can proof that stand, our movement around in front of the dog. If you're in the UK, you still want to proof the point stand to your movement, because sometimes a handler coming up behind a dog which is on point can sort of put a bit of pressure on the dog and push the dog forwards before they might have otherwise moved forwards. So we don't want them to experience our approach or our movement as pressure for them to move. So it's good to generalize it as well to that. And then we can also kind of make sure we get behaviors like the dog not being sticky at the flush. So we can kind of work on when we say get in, that the dog gets in, isn't sticky. So there's various different things that we can play with to help reduce the risk of stickiness at the flush. So anyway, I think this is a really great a kind of training process to put any dog through. The reason being that it builds a really strong default behavior around strong distractions. So it kind of teaches the dog the concept, as I said, that if they want to get something, they have to not try to get that thing. And the best way, the surest way to be allowed to get something that they want is by not trying to get the thing that they want. So I talk about it as if the tuggy is both the cue and the reinforcer. So the tug is both cueing the dog to do the behavior that we want. So when the dog sees the tuggy moving on the floor, that cues a certain behavior in the dog, but it's also the reinforcer. When the dog does that behavior, we release the dog to get the tug as the reinforcer for that behavior. So the tuggy is both the cue and the reinforcer for us. So that makes it a little bit different to other sports that use tug, like bite sports, for example. So it's kind of a little bit unique. And I really like this because what it does is it trains the dog to have these strong behaviors that when we move on to game, they're very likely to go back to these behaviors because these are the behaviors that have worked in the past. These are the behaviors which previously have seen them be allowed to get the thing that they want to get. And so when they are in the presence of, for example, game flushing, they're more likely to guess, oh, let's do this thing because this thing is what eventually lets me have access to the thing that I want. And, you know, when it's on game, they will not get immediate access to the thing they want. They're going to have to sit there while it's shot. But eventually, at the end of the chain, they will often get access to that thing they want when they're sent to retrieve it. So it will kind of play out there as well. It's very difficult to train a dog when we're not able to, you know, shoot things over them and go right through to that conclusion every single time. And I think using tugs and flirt poles in this way enables us to do some things which is very difficult to do with game and to kind of get some baby behaviors working. So this is a really great course if you have a young puppy or a young dog, or even if you have an older dog that still has some desire to play and interest in playing, then I think this course is going to be great for you guys too. If your dog doesn't have any interest in playing, the thing to experiment with is, are they interested in playing with the flirt pole? Because the flirt pole is, as I said, more exciting than a tug. So if you can get some play behavior happening with the flirt pole and interest in the flirt pole, then you'll be able to do this course. But if your dog's not really very interested in the flirt pole as a reinforcer either, then you probably can't do the course. Sometimes older dogs have kind of lost interest in play, which is a little bit sad sometimes, but it does happen. Sometimes because handlers haven't kept it up and kept up the play with them, so they haven't kind of kept it current in the dog's behavioral repertoire. So that can be a reason. But yeah, if you have a young dog, a puppy, or a dog which likes to play, then this is going to be a great course for you. So anyway, forcefreegundog.com, and then find the course called Steady. There's a discount code, as I said in the pre-roll, which is Hold the Line Steady. So if you put that in, you will get, I think it's 20% discount, and that's only valid for a month. So you want to make sure you get the course soon. Even if you can't follow it right now, you'll continue to have access to it and you can take it when you have time.
Hold the line.
So I had a question from a listener, which is, so it's from Chris, and he says, Hi Joe, I've read your book and listened to some of your podcasts. Apologies if you've answered this question already in another podcast. I don't think I have. The question is, are your dogs happier for having been trained force-free than they would have been had you trained them using aversives? I think this question is, okay, firstly, we have to say it's difficult to determine happiness in a dog. It's one of these things that, you know, we can't sort of climb inside a dog's head and experience the world from the perspective of the dog and know for sure if the dog is happy or not happy. But what we can do and what we do know is about stress behavior. So we do know when a dog's behavior is showing signs of stress, you know, panting, looking away, not making eye contact, trembling, shaking, whale eye, all these kinds of behavioral signs which indicate stress in the dog. And we know signs that show that a dog is happy and relaxed with sort of a nice relaxed mouth, relaxed body language, and generally looks content. So what I can say, because I've watched a lot of videos of dogs being trained using aversives from sort of top trainers around the world, and I would say they do have signs of stress. They do show signs of stress. One major sign that I've noticed is the dog really, really intensely mouthing the bumper as they come in to the handler. So it's almost like the dog carries the bumper still in their mouth while they're at a distance from the handler returning. And then as they come into this sort of few meter radius of the handler and start to slow down and anticipate the delivery, there's this intense chomping, 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 rolling of the bumper in the dog's mouth. And I attribute that to stress and pressure because I've not really seen that really kind of, it's almost obsessive, really intense chomping of the bumper in dogs that are trained in the UK. Even dogs that are trained in the UK without, you know, in traditional methods in the UK, because the UK doesn't use force fetch. So even traditional trainers in the UK don't use force fetch. So that kind of intense response to coming close to the handler, and I see that as a sign of stress. Anyway, the long and the short of it is that I think although we can't climb inside a dog's head and determine whether they are happy or not happy, we can observe external behaviors that the dog is showing us, and we do know which behaviors are associated with stress. And clearly dogs that are trained using aversives show lots more signs of stress than dogs that are trained using positive reinforcement. But yeah, so that would be my kind of answer to that question.
Hold the line.
Okay, folks, it's time for a whistle pause. A whistle pause is when there would usually be an advert from a sponsor. But I don't have a sponsor, so instead I'm going to play you a tune on my trusty Acme 212. Now, the tune there is slightly hampered by the fact that the 212 is just one pitch, but I hope you can appreciate the rhythm. Now, the reason that we've got this beautiful whistle pause instead of an advert is because I don't get any funding for this podcast or sponsorship. I record it, edit it, upload it myself, and I pay for the server. I don't want to get a sponsor because then I have to promote whatever business is sponsoring me. And apart from the fact that I think that most dog products are bollocks, I would lose some of the independence and the freedom that I have at the moment to say whatever I want to say about whatever I want to say it about. But if you want to support me, and if you like this podcast, then there are some ways that you can support me, which will also benefit you, I hope. So you can check out the online courses I make, which you can find at forcefreegundog.com. And you can also check out my book, Force Free Gundog Training, and the accompanying workbook for it, which is a planner called The Workbook. You can get both of these from Amazon wherever you live in the world. So I really hope you can support me and check out some of this material. Anyway, that is the end of today's whistle pause. Let's get back to the show. So I had a question from someone who was taking my online heel course this week. They didn't specifically ask me the questions that I could read it to you on the podcast, so I'm not going to kind of read it word for word or tell you who they are or anything like that, but I am going to kind of paraphrase a question because I think it was a really good question. And looking at the people that I have in my training classes, this is, I think, something which is touching on an issue that is really important for training heel work and having a dog which walks reliably at heel. So the question was, the people had a 14-week-old puppy, and they wanted to know, did they need to do all the sort of clicking and treating every single time they take their puppy out on lead? And what about times like when they need to take their puppy out just to go to the toilet? Because I think they lived somewhere where they didn't have a garden, and so they were taking the puppy out onto grass verges just outside the house to go to the toilet, so they had to put the lead on. And what about if the puppy were going to sniff something? Or what about if they wanted to just take a walk through the park or take a walk to get a coffee with the puppy? Or, you know, did they have to be doing all of this stuff with the lead on and clicking and treating the dog for paying attention to them, stopping when the lead goes tight, and implementing all of this heel work stuff all the time? So this is one of those subjects where I think there's like an optimal answer, which people don't really like, sadly. And, you know, another comparable situation might be, you know, when someone wants to know, do I have to get up through the night to take my puppy out to toilet, or can I just let them come out of a crate and toilet on the floor? So, you know, the answer there, by the way, is that it's going to be better. It's going to be optimal learning for your puppy. It's going to be faster if you can get up in the night and take the puppy out. But I also acknowledge that not everyone is going to do that. And this situation with the heel work thing is kind of the same. Like, there is an optimal answer. There's an answer which is like, this way is going to see your puppy have better heel work, have more reliable heel work long term. And, you know, a year down the line, 2 years down the line, you're going to have a better result than doing something else, meaning just letting the puppy tow you everywhere. But, you know, people don't like that answer because it's not convenient and it creates difficulties in everyday life sometimes. So, So basically, I would recommend if your puppy has to go on the lead to go to the toilet because you don't have a garden and you just need to pop outside your house, that you put on a lead which is kind of longer than the lead you would usually put on. You come outside your house and you hold the lead quite short, wait for your puppy to give you focus. As soon as the puppy looks at you, then you can say, go sniff, and indicate that they can go off and sniff. And by the way, with a really baby puppy, this is probably too difficult. Your puppy might not be able to offer you focus. You might have to wait till they get a bit older. But as soon as you start to be training focus in other contexts, and as soon as your puppy starts to get outside the socialization period, then this is one thing you can start to implement. So as soon as your puppy looks at you and gives you that attention, then you would say go sniff and release your puppy to go and sniff something nearby, or your dog to go and sniff something nearby, and to toilet as well in that process if they want to. And the reason to have the slightly longer lead is that then you can just let the dog go off like that, and you don't have to worry about the lead going tight and the dog pulling on the lead and all the rest of it. But this is not a walk, this is like a trip outside your house specifically to go to the toilet, and then you'll come back inside again. So it's like a kind of wander around the neighborhood sort of thing. So that is a subject that I wanted to kind of touch on, the whole wandering around subject. So, you know, I think people, before they get dogs, have this kind of romantic idea that would be really nice. The dog will just go with them everywhere. They'll wander about around town. They'll wander about through parks, and they'll go to cafes with the dog. And while you can do all of that, it's not always going to be optimal for your loose lead walking, especially if it's something the puppy grows up doing. So you need to be doing it during the socialization period. And I kind of identify a divide between puppies which are within the socialization period and what it's best to do with them, and then puppies that get outside the socialization period a bit older. So with a young puppy, I would be using a puppy house line because it's a bit longer than a usual lead, and letting the puppy have some freedom so they can really explore the world. If they want to stop and sniff something, they can. If they want to go, you know, run up a bank or hedge, they can, and then back down again. If they want to go backwards the way you've come, they can. I kind of leave it up to the puppy, the direction that we're walking in and where we're going. It's all about socialization and the puppy taking in the world. I tend to find that if we do training at this point, then especially if we've got a really foody puppy, we can end up with the puppy staring at us and really focused on us, which during the socialization period isn't necessarily a good thing, because the puppy isn't going to see the horse going by behind you. The puppy's not going to notice the truck at the end of the road. The puppy might not see the man with the umbrella because the puppy is just staring at you all the time because you've got food. So during the socialization period, I tend to dial right down the actual training and focus and that kind of stuff out and about in the world. I just try to expose the puppy to the world and to the situations where they will be put in future. Once the puppy's outside the socialization period, then there's not much benefit to keeping on doing that because they are not getting any socialization really to speak of from doing that. So that's the point where I start to introduce more focus on me and attention and, you know, heel work and that sort of stuff. So for me, there's kind of a divide there. So while you by all means might want to put your puppy house line on your puppy and wander around town with your baby puppy in the socialization period and take your puppy to cafes and take your puppy to pubs and take your puppy through the park, for me, there comes a point where once we get outside the socialization period, to keep doing all of that can become a bit counterproductive, because ideally, all the time that your puppy is on the lead, you want to be trying to implement your heel work training. And that can be difficult if you have a really sort of challenging walk ahead of you, like through a park, or if it's too long in terms of duration, or if it's past too many distractions. So ideally for your heel work, you want to be going backwards and forwards just outside your house on the lead and trying to make sure at first that you've got the technique working well, that your puppy understands the whole game of it. And then once you've got that working outside your house, you can gradually extend the places where you are doing this. So the other thing to say is, if you do want to sometimes take a walk somewhere a bit more distracting, but you need to keep the lead on, you probably want to use a much longer than usual lead. And when your puppy looks at you, you want to play the go sniff game. So when your puppy looks at you, you can click and treat and then release with go sniff to the back to the environment. So you're kind of building in focus on you, but you're also allowing your puppy to explore the environment and not expecting them just to walk at heel all the time. So that's what I would do if you need to kind of move off sometimes into these other places. Obviously, it's difficult to do that if you're walking through a town center. You might get tangled up quite a bit with a longer lead, and it can all get a little bit difficult. I remember About 15 years ago, I think it was now, we had our Weimaraner Slate as a puppy, and we lived in central Brighton at the time, which is a city. And what was even worse is that we just moved house and there was a long waiting list to be able to have a parking permit in our neighborhood. So that meant we had to park outside the parking permit area, which was really far away. It was probably like a 20-minute walk away. And so that was how far away our car was from our house. So in order to go anywhere with the puppy, we had to get the puppy that 20-minute walk from our house to the car. And sometimes I would use up so many treats doing that. I would feel like, how on earth am I going to then attend a training class after that? Because we had burned through so many treats. It often ended up being easier to walk and get the car and drive the car to the house and then pick up the puppy and then drive on from there than it was to walk the puppy to the car. So try and think about ways that you can avoid walking for excessive distances. Also try to avoid things like walking around the block and, you know, that sort of thing. People often think that they're giving their dog enjoyable physical exercise by walking them on the lead. But the fact is that dogs don't get much physical exercise from walks on the lead, especially active gun dog breeds. So they get their physical exercise off the lead. So walking on the lead and just walking around the block the same kind of route every day or night just isn't really very beneficial for the dog. So I think, you know, what does the dog need? The dog needs the toilet. You don't really need to be walking around the block for like 40 minutes letting your dog tow you, because that's just going to undo all of your heel work training. So my advice generally with the heel work is to really try and reduce the number of times that you need to do it. Try and, you know, do as little heel work as possible outside your kind of structured training sessions. There will come a point, of course, when your dog is trained and you can just walk through town or whatever with your dog at heel by your side and occasionally slip them a treat, and that will all just work perfectly. But that's not going to happen straight off the bat with a little puppy. You need to kind of develop these things gradually and, you know, work on that in a sort of gradual, progressive way. The last thing to say really is to think about why you are taking an outing. So people will often take their dog with them when the main reason for their outing is something else. So say you need to go post a letter, let's take the dog with us. Say you need to go get a coffee, let's take the dog with us. Say you need to, run an errand, let's take the dog with us. So it's kind of like the dog is like the secondary add-on thing. It's not the focus of your outing. It's not the whole reason that you're going out. And my advice is to try to avoid that. The reason being that you will have in your head this agenda, this place you want to get to, and you will feel frustrated about stopping, about clicking and treating, about everything that you have to apply in order to get there with your dog. It won't make it a quick and easy outing for you, and that will be frustrating too. And generally, you'll probably just let the training slide. So it's best to try to avoid those outings. I would recommend instead that if you do want to go out somewhere with your dog, that you go out specifically with that agenda. I am going out to train my dog, and that is the purpose of the outing, for example. So let's drive to town, let's park, let's get out the car. Let's see if my dog is able to focus on me and offer me attention in this environment. And if they're not, I won't start walking forwards, because walking forwards, if the dog is very distracted and looking everywhere else around me, that's just not going to work. They're not going to be able to do heel. So perhaps in that case, we just stand still and we just work on focus on me standing still. And maybe one or two steps in a couple of directions before we get back in the car and end the session. And if we have something we have to do in town, like we have to go post a letter, we can't do that. We can't dial the criteria right back down to what the dog needs, because we're working on what we need, which is to post a letter. So these things conflict, and often it's best to just prioritize the dog training when you can. And if you can't do that because you've got to do something else, then don't take the dog. Leave the dog in the car and go run the errand, or leave the dog at home and go run the errand. That would be my advice, at least while the dog is young and in training. Once the dog is trained, of course, you can combine these things with no problem. So I hope that makes sense. I think this is quite a complicated area, which again, sometimes doesn't get thought about or picked apart.
Hold the line.
That is all for this week, everyone, and I will see you soon.
Hold the line.